Yeah, thanks, Brittany. Just to start out, and by the way, I brought my own markers today from home. So yeah. I wanted to just reiterate something that we talked about already a couple times, but just, and I appreciate you all being here, and obviously you see the importance of this, either that or your spouse made you come this morning, or somebody made you come, but I just want to reiterate the fact that apologetics is so important. And I think to bring it on a personal level, we talked about some of the reasons why, but I just want to bring out a couple of personal things, that there are people in the community, in your jobs, maybe in your extended families, that are struggling with these questions. They're struggling with questions about God and Jesus and the whole faith thing, the whole Christianity thing, and trying to work through it potentially, or have questions about it or doubts about it. Just to give you a few examples, I just learned recently that I have a member of my own family that's questioning a lot of things, who was brought up in church and has been a part of a church for a long time, that's questioning the Christian faith and its truthfulness. I recently met with a guy who attended church here once that was a friend of somebody that goes to this church, who was raised in a somewhat Christian home, but watched some videos online and is having some major doubts about how he can even remotely believe in the Christian faith. And then just even on a, with people within our church, I think there's people in the church, in this church, in our church, that are having questions. I've met with three people in the last year, and I met with a guy this morning that are just having questions about things about the Bible. How can we know the Bible is true? And how can we know that Jesus is God? And I realize everybody's been telling me that, but how can I know that is the case? How can we defend that? And these people, we owe it to them to give them answers. We don't want this to be a place where they feel ashamed to ask questions, but it needs to be a place where they can ask questions, and then we are able to help them and point them towards the truth. But we have to know that for ourselves before we can do that. And I think a lot of people end up getting pushed away because we're not able to help them in that process. And so I just really want us to make sure that not only in this class but in this church that we foster an environment where questions are okay and they're handled appropriately, and that we as Christians are preparing ourselves to be able to deal with our own questions and deal with questions and doubts and struggles of friends and other people in our church. So having said that, let me give a quick recap of last week. We're kind of going through, and today we'll finish up looking at some reasons why we believe that God exists, maybe some evidences that we see around us in the world or internally of why we believe in the God that we believe in. Last week we talked about the cosmological argument, which basically says that everything that exists, that begins to exist, has a cause, and that's very obvious to us. We believe that the universe began to exist, and we gave some reasons why we believe that's the case. And then we said the universe had to have a cause. And if you remember, the universe being time, space, energy, matter, all these things that comprise what we see. And the only thing that could be a cause for that would have to be something that's immaterial, very powerful, timeless, spaceless. And it lined up very much with what our definition was of God, the conception of God that we have as Christians. And for those that weren't here, I'll be posting that, and there'll be an email being sent out, and you could listen to that or check that out online. So today what I want to do, instead of going very in-depth with just one argument, and I realize it was fairly in-depth and maybe a little complicated at a couple points, and made your brain hurt maybe, I want to talk about maybe three or four or five things today that are evidences that point towards the existence of God. And these will be things, other arguments that you can put in your tool belt, so to speak, that may be helpful for you and resonate with you, but may also be helpful engaging in other people. I realize that not everybody's wired the same way, so one evidence for one person may not do anything, but for somebody else, it may really ring a bell for them. So today we're going to talk about things beauty, and the aesthetics, things that we see in nature and the world around us, and music and art and things like that, and how it points to God. We'll look at things like morality, desire in the human heart, the fine-tuning of the universe, and a couple other things. And I'm not going to go like super in-depth with these. There's obviously people have rebuttals to them, and there's counter-rebuttals to those. So I'm just going to offer up a few things and maybe commend those to you. And if you want to further dive into those, you can do that. And again, what we're trying to do in this class, and we can't do it fully, but if this circle, or this somewhat supposed to be a circle, represents all that we believe as Christians about the Christian worldview, what we're trying to do in this class is take different slices of the Christian worldview and show that they resonate with what is real in the world around us. We want to show their truthfulness and defend it. Okay, so last week we talked about the universe. And so it's just one slice of what we believe and how the Christian worldview has explanatory power over that one little slice of reality. And today we'll talk about some other evidences. And then maybe we'll discuss Jesus and his resurrection one week. And maybe we'll talk about the scriptures and why we believe they're God's word. But we're trying to, and we won't get it in the whole class, we're trying to take little slices of reality and little slices of the Christian worldview and show their truthfulness. Okay, so we're not trying to say, let me give you one reason why I believe all of Christianity is true. No, we believe a worldview, and then we're going to go down through different parts of it and show why those things are true and why we can defend those. And before we dive into our first argument, I want to give kind of a warning that I think is appropriate. A lot of people and a lot of Christians and a lot of well-meaning Christians, when they're talking about the existence of God and they're talking to someone maybe who does not believe the way we believe or does not believe in a God, a lot of Christians will resort to what's kind of called the God of the gaps argument or God of the gaps fallacy. And basically what they say is that if we can't understand or explain what it is, that therefore God must have done it. So we can't understand why the weather moves the way it does, therefore God did it. Or like people used to think they can't understand how the sun would come up and go down, so obviously God is like moving it and making it go. Or the same with the stars. And the reason why that's bad for us to do that as Christians, like let's say we observe something in nature that happens and we just can't explain it. It seems unexplainable to us. The reason we should avoid saying, well, God made it do that. In a real sense, we do believe that God is in control of everything. And so in an ultimate sense, he does cause everything to be the way it is. But is usually in nature, there's typically causes for things in nature. So more than likely, we're going to ultimately find the cause of the thing that it is, whether it was the sun revolving around the earth or whatever. And so as Christians, we should expect to see things and causes happen in nature. So for us to too quickly say God miraculously makes A, B, or C happen can ultimately in the end, after it's shown that there is some other cause that makes it happen, can make Christians look silly, like we're like it's the escape hatch for trying to figure things out, if that makes sense. So we're like, oh, we can't figure out what that is, so must be God. Okay, so we do believe God made everything. He's in control of everything, and he ordains everything, and he works through his creation. But he's also set in motion natural processes that work themselves out as well. And he is in control of those and can intervene as he sees fit as well. But I think that's a good warning for us. And a lot of Christians have done that in the past, and it's made the church look very silly at times. Okay, to start off, our first evidence for the for God's existence and why we believe in the God that we believe in, I want to do kind of a little interactive I'm going to divide the room up into two halves, okay? So we're going to debate for a second the idea of homosexual marriage or same-sex marriage. Okay, so this side of the room, actually, I'll make it this side of the room. This side of the room will be for gay marriage, okay? So you have to give me arguments. I did that for you, Dad. You have to give me... Y'all have to give me arguments for why you think we should legalize same-sex marriage, why the whole same-sex marriage movement, the homosexual movement, the gay rights movement, give me arguments for that, okay? And you all give me arguments against that, okay? Why you think it's not right, why we should not legalize same-sex marriage, why that movement is not good for the culture, why it's not good in general. Okay, so... we'll just go back and forth. So give me an argument. You who are for...
can't legislate morality.
Okay. Give me another one.
You want equality?
Okay, equality.
Can't help the way they were born. Can't help the way they were born.
Okay. And so why, dig a little deeper, why is that?
Is there another way?
Yeah, so we should...
love them anyway.
Okay, yeah, okay, we should love people for the way they are, okay?
Marriage is a government institution and Christian convictions shouldn't have anything to do with it.
Okay, maybe, so don't push your views on other people, maybe?
Yeah.
Okay, you guys, y'all think some more. Y'all give me some.
Well, society, some views against. Out.
Okay. Okay, not good for society. Okay, so what would be some other reasons why it's not good for society?
Procreation.
Yeah. Yeah, you're MSNBC over here, Fox News over here. Okay, so society would die out. Okay, what else?
God created a man and woman, not man and man.
Okay. Why else would it not be good for society?
You have to have some type of definition of marriage where you have a guy and four wives and a harem or,
okay,
you know, polygamy or...
okay, so maybe some sort of order in the family unit, maybe?
I mean, having an issue when Utah wanted to become a state, they had to get rid of polygamy.
Okay. Yeah, really?
Yeah.
Interesting. Okay. Yes.
The difference in the anatomy,
okay,
of a man,
yep,
and a woman should tell you.
I won't ask you this.
That is not.
She probably would.
Teleological anatomy, meaning like it has an end, like there's a goal in the anatomy, like it's very obvious that it has serves a specific purpose. Okay, what else? Like, I would say another one to help you guys out would be health-related issues. So I think there's an argument for the health and well-being of people. Okay, back to you guys. What else? Y'all had time to think. Y'all never watched like Rachel Maddow or anything like that?
The issue of adoption, and there's homosexual people that want to adopt,
okay,
kids and love, have a loving family just like heterosexual families.
Thank you, liberal brother. Okay, yeah. Kids need adopted, okay? Anything else?
As long as it's consensual, they love each other.
Okay.
Civil rights.
Against it, okay, wouldn't it be, yeah, like a position?
So what kind of rights, Luke? Like equality, maybe?
Well, the whole idea is, since about, when was that book written? About 1986. I'm trying to remember the author's names. They wrote a book about how they needed to change the society's perception of homosexuality from a behavior to a civil right in order to be able to justify legalizing it. So they want to treat it like racial segregation, that it is wrong somehow to differentiate between people based upon their sexual preference,
right?
Just like it's wrong to differentiate between color.
Okay.
So they want to argue on that basis.
Okay. Yeah, so I would just say equality or human rights. Okay, any more from over here? They're killing you guys. That's why we're about to legalize same-sex marriage. Come on.
I don't care if they're wrong.
Yeah, they're wrong. Okay. I would say similarly.
I would go back on the civil rights. It's a behavior. Going back, it is a behavior and not a race issue.
Yeah. Sure.
And we legislate behavior all over the place.
Sure. Oh, yeah. Every law is based on behavior, right? Yes.
If you believe in the Bible, I believe somewhere in there it says one man and one woman.
Sure. All over, right. Yes, it does. Okay. Another against, I would think, would be that we're for strong families or a strong family unit.
That'd be traditional, though, right?
Mm-hmm. Huh?
It's traditional family.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I would argue that both sides are for strong family unit. These mm-hmm. just like they can redefine it differently. Okay, that's good enough. All right. So, as you compare these two things, do you notice anything about this at all? Anything? Are there any similarities between the two sides? Yeah, okay, maybe what are some of the similarities?
There's too many on that side.
Yeah.
Both of them want a strong family unit.
Yeah.
Okay, right, okay.
Love.
Yeah, love, right. And if you'll notice, one of the interesting things is we do have a disagreement about this, but there's really very little disagreement here between the two sides. So, the arguments against same-sex marriage and the arguments for, they both assume a lot of the same things. So, they both, like the people that are against it, are not against equality. They're not against human rights. They're not against loving people. They're not against kids being adopted. Okay? So, the people that are against it are not saying, are not arguing against these things. And these people here are not against strong families. They're not against the health of society and the good of society. They're arguing why their view is good for society, and it is good for family units, and it is good for health. So if you catch my drift, what I'm trying to say is that everybody, and this would help us as we look at political debates that are so divided, is that both people have, and both sides, both spectrums of people, they both have a similar moral code that they understand, a conscience. They both have a morality, I would argue, that we all agree on. Okay, so we're not disagreeing on the fact that we're saying you don't deserve equality, and they're saying, no, we do deserve equality. We all agree that equality and human rights are a good thing. We're not saying you should not love people, and they're saying, no, you should love people. No, we all understand that loving people is a good thing. And so anytime that we argue about anything, there is an underlying moral code that anytime people are arguing about that they agree upon. So whenever I tell anyone, hey, you shouldn't do that, or you should do that, say, you shouldn't push me, you shouldn't take that, they're not going to come back and say, oh, yes, I should do that, it's right for me to steal. No, they're going to find some excuse to show why what they did didn't actually violate the morality that you're trying to hold them to, because they understand that there is a moral code. Does that make sense to you all? So in every argument, we see that. Anytime you hear anyone arguing, anytime you tell anyone anything, anytime you use the word should or ought with anyone, you're implying that there is a moral code that they are obliged to keep. That there is a morality, there is something above both of you that you're both subject to, that you both have to obey. And we see this in every argument, no matter how liberal the person is that you're dealing with, they understand this. And so if there is a binding moral code, if there's a code out there of morality that's binding on all people, that regardless of culture, regardless of time period, there is a moral code that is universal, it's over all men. As Christians and as anyone who appeals to this moral code, they have to ask the question, where did it come from? Why is there this code out there that's invisible, it's immaterial, that presses itself upon every person, and everybody knows that they have to adhere to it? So that even when somebody really wants homosexuality and homosexual marriage to be legalized, they still know that they have to appeal to this moral code in order to make a valid argument about it. And so, as Christians, what we believe is that there is a God who is a moral being who is himself goodness, and that code comes from him. Because the only way for there to be a code that's binding upon us is if there is an authority over us that's handing that down, that has the authority to make it binding upon us. And so every single person in the world understands this morality that's written on their hearts, that's written on their conscience, that they are to obey. And what's more is they realize that they have disobeyed it, and there's guilt in most people for having done wrong. And we should see as Christians that this points to a lawgiver. The fact that we have a law implies that there is someone who gave the law. And it can't be any man, it can't be any society, it has to be someone outside of man, because this law is over top of all man. Does that make sense to you all? Is there any questions about that? Or
How do we build an argument for, let's say, someone tells you in response to that there are certain things in societies that are completely unacceptable, where here they would be acceptable, but then some things are, they might say that to say that morality has evolved in certain cultures. And sure, there are
right.
things that transcend all cultures, but that some things have evolved in certain cultures as being right, whereas across the ocean they might be completely wrong.
Yeah. I think, for one, that maybe overstates it a little bit, because I think you'd be hard-pressed to find too much of that. But two things that I would say about that is, even if a certain people claim that something is right when it's really wrong, they could be violating their own conscience in doing that. And so just because we have a group of people saying something is right doesn't mean that that code is still not there. They just may be violating on that on their own. But the second thing I would say is, and I'll just give some examples before I give the explanation, is you look at things like slavery. So slavery seems to be morally acceptable in some cultures, and it was here for a time being. So there was a time when it was considered okay for slavery to exist. Or in Nazi Germany, it was in their country, it was okay to kill the Jews and to torture them and to put them off in concentration camps. So did that mean it was moral over there? And I would say no, and I would say the reason is this, is what they did is they knew that enslaving or killing human beings was wrong. So what did they do? They made an argument or crafted an argument to show that those people were not truly human. A lot of them used like Darwinian theory that, you know, whites are more highly evolved and that we're the superior race and they're kind of subhuman, so it gave us kind of the okay to do that. So they still had that underlying morality that there is human rights, there is human dignity, we should not do these things to our fellow man, but what they did is they said these people are not truly human. And they did the same with the blacks during the slavery movement. They would act as if there was some good reason why they should be able to do the things they did to them. So they still acknowledge the moral code, but what they did is they gave excuses or reasons to be able to carry out the deeds they wanted to do anyway. Does that make sense?
They're still doing it today with abortion.
Yes, correct. Absolutely. It's a good example. They have to they know it's wrong to kill a human, an innocent human being, so they craft arguments to try to show it's not an innocent human life. And so the code has never gone away.
There's a proverb that says there's a way that seems right to a man, but in the end, it leads to death.
Yeah.
So that's one thing that comes to mind. And the other thing that you're talking about is it's all in Romans 1.
Yes.
Basically, God gives them, you know, God gives them over.
That's right.
But yet, men are without excuse.
That's right. Yeah, I'll just read. I had this written down. Romans 2:14-15 says, "For when the Gentiles who do not have the law..." So think about it. There was a law. Moses didn't get the law until a couple thousand years after the creation of mankind, or however long. There was a long period of time. So there was no law. And the Gentiles, the people that were not Jews, that were not the covenant people of God, they didn't have the law either. But it says, even though they didn't have the law, by nature they do what the law requires. They are a law to themselves, even though they do not have the law. They show that the work of the law is written on their hearts, while their conscience also bears witness, and their conflicting thoughts accuse or even excuse them. So every man has this written on their hearts. And also, like David said, we've all rebelled against that. So we twist it and we distort it and we try to go our own way that we think is right, while at the same time, that law is still there pressing itself upon us. And that's why no man, I don't think, regardless of where they're at in the world, will be able to stand before God, because they know they have broken His law. I think it's written on their hearts. So any questions about that before we move on to the next one? Yeah.
There's a lot of Muslims who would say they would believe in a universal moral code too.
Mm-hmm.
And they would look at Americans, Christian Americans, and say that, well, they're just violating their conscience too.
Yeah.
I think it's a very convenient thing to state that, well, they believe that this is right, but they're probably just violating their conscience. You know, do you see what I'm
sure.
saying? Like, that can be used by anybody.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
All over the world, I mean.
Absolutely. So I think, and that's a good point. So what I'm wanting to show is that there is that moral code that everyone has written on their heart. And it's that in and of itself, I think, that points to God, to the God that we believe in. So we haven't narrowed that down to the Christian God necessarily, but we believe in God. We believe in a God who is lawgiver. And I think this universal fact of morality that is written on the conscience of mankind points and gives evidence to what we believe about God. Anything else? And again, I am not like addressing every single counter argument. We'd be here for days and days.
I think that
but feel free to raise anything you want. It's fine.
The most convincing argument that I've heard for universal morality without a God as a lawgiver has been, and I'm not saying I buy into it, I'm saying this is the one that I've heard most often, is that whatever would lead to human flourishing,
right,
would be what our moral compass would be based on.
Sure.
We know it's wrong to kill because that's against human flourishing.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's typically an evolutionary argument.
Yeah. Yeah, it's the humanist perspective, right?
Position. What would you say to that?
Yeah, I mean, I would just say that they just invented that. I mean. Like they, I mean.
But even if it's correct, does homosexuality do that?
No, it doesn't. That's a really good point. Because most people that would hold to that would also hold to same-sex marriage and homosexuality, which contradicts that. So you're right. Yeah. But yeah, they just invented it. So why not? Okay, I say that we should do whatever is good for me and not human flourishing. So I say I kill you. You know? What do they appeal to? They don't like it? You know, so I guess what I would say is that there's no grounding for their morality. And so any morality they come up with is just an invention of their own mind, or a collection of, as society, that we're going to agree on this. But it doesn't make it right or wrong, that particular thing. So yeah, that is what they would say. And I agree, we should do what's good for humanity, but they have no grounding for why they would say that. They just kind of invented it out of thin air. And what keeps you from coming up with your own of what's good for the Barnhards is what's moral. So, Okay, let me move on, because I got a couple other ones in that took a little longer than I thought. Okay, the second thing that points towards the Christian worldview, I think, specifically the immaterial realm. We believe that God is not physical, so he does not have a body, that he is spirit, the scriptures say. And this causes some trouble for people because they think, well, I can't see him, so therefore he doesn't exist. Or how can I know he's real if I can't see him with my eyes? And so in order to help us with that and point to that immaterial reality, I think it helps us to turn inward and look at ourselves and what we are as human beings. And so I want to argue for the concept of the soul, that I believe that we have a soul, that there is an immaterial you that makes you who you are. There is a ghost in the proverbial machine, like there is somebody inside of you, so you're not your body. But there is an immaterial you that is inside of you that utilizes your body to live and act and think and do all those kinds of things. And so by a soul, when I say that you have a soul, so picture this as your soul. And what the soul is, I believe, is a collection of your different faculties. So things like your will, your conscience. I would argue your spirit, which is maybe the part of you that is in relationship with God. Let's see, what else here? Your senses. So like your five senses, the things that you're able to look, see, smell, taste, feel, emotions. There's other things, but it's a collection of your faculties. So these things here make you, you, okay? And everyone's is unique, and that's why everyone is a unique individual. And so as Christians, the question we would ask ourselves is, what could be the cause of such an immaterial reality? And the fact is that it points to another immaterial reality beyond ourselves, one that would obviously possess these same types of attributes, namely God. And so if we have good reason to believe that the soul exists and that we are an immaterial being, that we're not just our body, that we're not confined to just what here is flesh and bones, then we have good reason to believe in the immaterial realm, the spirit realm. We have good reason to believe in God as well. So it doesn't make that argument against us carry much weight, the fact that we can't see God. Does this make sense? Any questions about this? So I haven't proved the soul yet, but does that make sense? Okay, here's three arguments that I would give for why I think we have a soul. The first one is that we can't be divided into parts. So regardless of how much of my body that I lost, I would still be 100% me, okay? So if I lost all of my limbs and I was nothing but my head and my torso, I would still be 100% Jordan. I'm not like 60% now, so like I'm kind of the same guy that I used to be. No, I'm 100% me. This is not like a knockdown proof or anything, but it's a very intuitive notion that we are not the extremities or the parts of our body, okay? The second thing is, another argument for the existence of the soul, is that we endure through time. And so if you think about your own memories, if you think about, if you introspect a little bit, and you think about like childhood memories and memories from several years ago and now, it's the same you that has experienced all of those things. And so a lot of times when I look in the mirror at myself, I see a body that's older than what it used to be, but I still see like the same me. And so it's like I'm looking at a different body, but yet it's the same person that I was when I was 10. It's a very strange phenomenon to think about that. And that dawned on me one day as I was thinking about just my immortality, that we believe as souls that we will live forever. Like there's a part of me that stays fixed, I guess. That's not aging or dying or whatever. Now, people who don't believe in a soul, what they believe that we are as humans it's just a collection of parts. So we're like our brain, we're the neurons in our brain, we're the, you know, the C fibers firing, we're our limbs, and we're just a collection of parts. Okay, so there's not like a central self, and then there's this stuff around us, okay, but we're just a collection of all these parts. But here's the problem for that, is if we're just a collection of parts, then over time we change and we're not the same person that we used to be, literally. So, and I think it's every 7 years that all the cells in your body die out. Is that it, Charles? You're supposed to know that, right? You're a doctor. But I think every so many years, like, all of your cells are constantly, they're dying and new ones are replacing those old ones. And so, very literally, if there is no soul, if there is no unchanging essence inside of every person, then as your cells die off and new ones come about, you're not the same person, literally, that you used to be if there is no soul. And so think about a guy that's like sitting in prison for a crime he committed 10 years ago. He could realistically go to the judge and say, hey, it was not me. It was some other guy that lived 10 years ago, but it certainly was not me. Okay, so that creates a lot of problems for moral accountability if there's not a central self that is unchanging inside of you. And finally, a really interesting problem in neurology is called the binding problem. So whenever you look and perceive things around you, your brain is doing a lot of things at one time. So there's a part of your brain, like you're seeing color, you're seeing, you're hearing sounds, you're getting depth perception about things, you're seeing action and things that are moving in front of you. So you have all these different things about the stuff you're seeing around you. So there's textures, there's the way things feel, all of this stuff about your senses. And what's interesting is that different parts of your brain process those different perceptions that you're getting. So when you look out, I'm seeing colors, I'm seeing depth, I'm seeing height, I'm seeing textures, and all those things are being processed in different parts of my brain. And neurologists are very puzzled as to how your brain puts all that together and you actually see one cohesive object, the actual visual field that I'm seeing, in your mind's eye. And they can't explain that neurologically because there's no mechanism for what causes you to actually see. Like in your brain, there's a you that's seeing everything your eyes are giving the information about. And so it points to a unified self that's like collecting all the data that your brain's getting and then giving you an image that you are seeing. It's really fascinating. So that's three arguments for that. There are some counter arguments for the soul. Did you have a question?
Wouldn't your last argument be, how'd you explain that with like animals and stuff? They would process, you know, the depth and color and stuff, and they're able to see.
Yeah, I think animals have a soul too. I think it's different than the human soul. I don't think it's eternal, and I don't think they have some of the same parts, but I think to a certain degree they have a soul, I would argue. And that sounds very non-Christian, but I think that's the case. The scripture talks about that a lot of the animals, the land animals, I think it calls them nephesh, but they're soulless creatures is what the interpretation is of the Hebrew. Yes.
My dad used to work with brain injured clients, mm-hmm. Whole group therapies, yep. For guys who had some kind of traumatic brain injury. Mm-hmm. And you would have guys in there who literally had like a pole or something sticking out of their head.
Yeah.
And they'd know that certain parts of the brain, for example, with like conscience, mm-hmm. Impulse control, like there would be a guy there who would drink a lot ever since, yep. Like his brain injury, or had like constantly been cussing, just various different, mm-hmm. impulse problems. So in a sense, his conscience was changed.
Correct.
You know what I'm saying? Or like you might have a guy who, when you're talking about like emotions, used to be a real chill guy, mm-hmm. got hit in the head, and now he's just angry all the time, or yep. anxious or whatever. Kind of point, I think you can take all those things in that circle and you'll find that origin in the brain. And yeah, we don't understand the brain completely.
Yep.
I'm not going to make that claim at all.
Sure.
But
okay, so basically the question to get at what you're saying is that how can we say that all these things like emotions and will are not just the material processes that are going on in our brain? Because when something happens to some of those material processes, it seems to alter maybe our emotions. It's like you could go in and probe something in my brain and cause my emotions to kind of go out of whack a little bit. And what I would say about that is that our soul and our brain are interconnected in a way that I can't explain. Like you said, I can't explain all of that. So one does not operate apart from the other. Okay, so because I can cause my brain and cause my emotions to do things, but at the same time, if my brain starts getting out of whack, it can have effects on me, I feel like, that cause me to want to react and overreact in certain ways. So there seems to be a correlation between the two, that where they both are acting on one another. But what I would say to that is that just because there's a correlation between two things does not mean that the two things are identical. And so there's what's called the Leibniz's law of identity. So if two things are exactly the same thing, so if my emotions or my will or my thoughts are the exact same thing as my brain, then everything that's true about my brain should be true about my thoughts. Okay? Does that make sense? So if my thoughts are nothing more than C fibers firing and neurons firing, then everything that's true about my thoughts should be true about the C fibers firing and the stuff that's going on in my brain. And I think there's lots of things about our thoughts or about our will that are not true of just the material processes that are going on in our brain. So our thoughts, for instance, can have truth value to them. So if I'm thinking a thought, it can be true or false. But a brain state cannot be true or false. It just is. Like, it just is what it is. So there's no truthfulness to it. So that would mean that the two things are different from one another. And we could go on and on about different things in here, that things that these characteristics or attributes that these possess that brain states do not possess. So I think they're very much interconnected, but they're not the same thing. So I think you're right. And I think, so we are very much tied to our body. So I'm not saying our soul exists apart from our body, because I think in the new heaven and new earth, we'll get a new body. But I don't think they're the same thing. And we can talk about that more, because it gets really complicated. Okay, a couple other things. That's a really good question, though. That's a very common question. And most people in neurology would go with that approach. They like to say that we don't have a soul. So it's more of an atheistic view. A couple other, quickly, another argument is called the fine-tuning argument. So our universe, there's lots of constants in our universe, which just means that there's certain ways that things are in our universe. That's just the way they are. It's like gravity. It's 9.81 meters per second squared is the constant of gravity. It's just like that anywhere you go in the universe, okay? It's not like constantly changing, and that's why our feet stay firmly planted where we're at right now. It's because gravity is constant all the time, all right? If it became less, we would start floating, right? And if it became more, we would be crushed. There's other constants like the cosmological constant or the expansion rate of the universe, like that it's expanding at a certain rate. So there's all these constants. The speed of light is a constant. It's just the way that it is. Okay, and these values could have been anything differently. There's nothing that causes them to be the way that they are. All right, but consider this. There's like 40, 50 plus constants out there that if they were altered in any way, then life could not exist or the universe could not exist. So for instance, gravity, if it were altered by 1 or 10 to the 40th. So that's 1 with 40 zeros after it, okay? If it were altered by that much in one direction or the other, so if it was just a little bit stronger or a little bit less, then life could not exist in the universe. And just to kind of help you picture what 1 times 10 to the 40 is, if you imagine a ruler stretched from one end of the universe to the other with 1-inch increments on it, it's like 1 inch, okay? Just moving it 1 inch one way or the other would cause life not to be able to exist. Another one, the electron-proton mass ratio is precisely the way it is, and if it was 1 times 10 to the 37th, one way or the other, then there could be no chemical bonding that could happen. So there would be no chemistry, which would mean there would be no life at all. There would be no universe. If it were changed by this much, plus or minus. Okay, and just to give you an idea of what this is, imagine that you cover the entire North American continent in dimes all the way up to the moon, a height of almost 240,000 miles. Next, pile dimes from here to the moon on a billion other continents the same size as North America. Paint one dime red and mix it into the billions of piles of dimes. Blindfold a friend and ask him to pick out one dime. The odds that he will pick the red dime are 1 in 10 to the 37th power. So you can imagine how improbable that is. Okay, so there are numerous concepts like this that have to be exactly the way they are before life could exist in the universe, okay? So it's literally, like, just imagine this huge machine, okay? And there's all these settings, okay? And there's, like, all these little dials everywhere that represent all the constants in the universe. And it is literally like someone has placed all of the dials. They're exactly set, exactly right. They're finely tuned such that life could exist in the universe. Okay, this becomes a very big problem for the person who does not believe in a fine tuner or someone who has a creator, because these things, you would have to believe that all this happened by chance or by some physical necessity. And that just becomes very, very, very problematic. I don't want to get into a ton of that just for time's sake, so I'm going to move on to another one. But does this make sense to you guys? A finely tuned universe seems to speak to a fine tuner. That seems fairly straightforward to me. Okay, the next one would be the argument from beauty. This is kind of neat. There's an argument that says, there is the music of Johann Sebastian Bach, therefore there must be a God. In all seriousness, and maybe for people who love music, they would understand that. But there are very good musicians. So there is Bach, there is Beethoven, there is Vivaldi. There's these guys are just unbelievably brilliant when it comes to music. Okay? And then there's me. All right? So if I went and tried to compose something or play something, what would you say? Or if I went and took Brandon's spot up on the stage, okay? You guys would not say that my music was good, not even close, okay? Or if I tried to paint something as opposed to Angela Hatfield painting something, you would prefer her painting over mine, okay? Because I stink at painting. And the point is this, there are standards of beauty. So, and I'm not going to go fully into explaining why I believe this is so, but as we look out, we recognize intuitively that there are some things that are beautiful, there are some things that are good when it comes to art and music, and there are some things that are bad and they're ugly. And as Christians, we believe there is a standard of beauty, and that is God. Okay, and when we're creating good music and we're creating good art, what we're doing is mimicking the beautiful Creator. And so for there to be a standard of beauty, there must be someone who establishes that standard. And so, if there is no real standard, then we cannot really say that Bach is good. We can just say some people preferred Bach, you know, or some people preferred Beethoven. But we couldn't say that his music is good or it is excellent or it is beautiful because there would be no standard. But I think we all know that there truly is a standard, and that's why Bach is a famous composer. That's why, you know, Van Gogh or some of these other artists are famous artists. It's because their stuff was truly good. It was truly beautiful. And that means that there is a standard that we measure things against to say yay or nay. That's beautiful, that's not beautiful. And let me just move on to the very last one so I get through all these. And I realize I'm going through very fast. But this would be the argument from desire. And it's that in each person, this is a really neat argument that C.S. Lewis developed. Every one of us has desires that we're born with, just innate desires. So things like sleep, hunger, food, sex, all these things, there are desires that we have as human beings that are natural to us, not desires we create like wanting to go to Disney or watch a sports game, but there are innate desires that we have. And there is always an object to fulfill those desires. So when we have the desire, we're hungry, and there's a desire for food, there is food to fulfill that desire. When we're tired, there is sleep to fulfill that desire. When we desire sex, there is an object to fulfill that desire. So there is an an end to meet all of our desires that we have as human beings. But I would argue that in every human being, there is also a desire that transcends anything that this world can meet. So everybody has an emptiness or a desire that nothing on this earth can satisfy. And I think all I can do is ask you to introspect. I can't prove that. But that seems to be the notion. No one is truly satisfied with all the money in the world. If you look at all the rich rulers, they're miserable. Or people who have attained fame and status. Like, it never pays on its promises. Like, it always leaves people wanting for more. And that seems to be the story of humanity, is chasing after filling that hole, filling that desire, for which nothing can satisfy. And I would argue that if there is a desire that nothing physical can meet or nothing temporal can meet, that there's something beyond the material world that was made to fulfill that desire. And I'll just summarize and read what C.S. Lewis said. Well, hold on, let me back up. And what that desire, the way we see that desire is when we go see like a really good sports game, let's say, and we see the talent of the athletes and the excitement, like we're left excited, but then at the same time, if you're anything like me, you kind of are like, ah, man, I want more. Like, I'm not satisfied with that. I want more excellence. I want more talent. I want more awesomeness. Or if you hear something really good, like good music, at the end, you're like, I want more. I want more. I want more of that goodness. I want more of that whatever it is. Like, it's constantly pointing to, like, infinitely more. We want infinitely more of what's good. And so C.S. Lewis said, creatures are not born with desires unless satisfaction for those desires exists. A baby feels hunger, well, there is such a thing as food. A dolphin wants to swim, well, there is such a thing as water. Men feel sexual desire, well, there is such a thing as sex. If I find in myself a desire which no experience in this world can satisfy, the most probable explanation is that I was made for another world. And I think it's very true. As we look in our own hearts, I think it speaks and it screams to that fact that we want something that nothing here will offer. And I think that points to God as well. So sorry that was so quick. If you have any questions, feel free to come up afterwards and ask. And we'll go ahead and close out. Let me close in prayer, if that's cool. God, thank you for the truth of your word. Thank you for truth in general and that you made it known to us. Help us to be open to that truth and hungry for it, that we would seek what is true and cling to it. That we would savor it, God, that we would see that it points to you and that we would be changed by it. It's in Christ's name I pray. Amen.